This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy.
Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them, and guess what? That's normal. Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online.
Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both.
See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hi, everyone. Today on the show, we have a returning guest, Tia Levings. I love the way Tia speaks. She has this beautiful speaking style, and we got into some very interesting stuff while we were talking today. I'm so excited to have you hear this episode. Tia Levings writes about the realities of Christian fundamentalism, evangelical patriarchy, and religious trauma. She is also a podcaster and a speaker and a content strategist, and she's been quoted in Salon, The Huffington Post, and Newsweek, and appeared in the hit Amazon docuseries, Shiny Happy People. Based in Jacksonville, Florida, she is mom to 4 incredible adults and likes to travel, hike, paint, and daydream. I love that. Her debut memoir, A Well-Trained Wife, is available now for pre-order. Here is Tia Levings. It is lovely to have Tia Levings back with me today, who is now getting this stronghold in the publishing world, darling. And it's very exciting. And so we want to hear about all of that, all of it, which is so amazing. And I'm not surprised because I was taken the first time when we were talking about how well you synthesize what you've been through and how you can put it into this sort of palatable form, like make it understandable, which often happens, I think, if you're good with words, but also if you're a writer. How do I put this in a way where people will pick it up and get it and really honor my experience also all at once, you know? So very nice to have you back. If you can just take a moment for people who didn't happen to hear the first part, and I hope they go back and listen to it after we talk today. If you can just introduce yourself and then we'll start talking.
Yes, it is so lovely to be back a second time. And that's happening a little bit more as my first round of interviews going back. And it is honoring to the story because I feel like this is a very human way to connect over hard things and uncover like the way we're impacted as a collective. So I'm Tia and I wrote A Well-Trained Wife, which is the story of my entrance into and escape from a very high control Christian patriarchy, which I am now calling, I'm referring to it more often as the evangelical patriarchy because it's a very specific thing in America. And it's also a cult without walls. So there's a lot of fellow survivors who will relate to my story or resonate with pieces of it. But we maybe did not belong to the same denomination. But we are all in the American Protestant evangelical tradition that's been impacted by Christian fundamentalism over the past 50 years. So there's common resonance in my story. That is what I do now. I educate on the abuses in Christian fundamentalism, both on my Substack and through my books. And I'm working on my second book, which is picking up where the other one left off, but more of a healing focus and more of a here's how I healed and how you can too kind of support. I'm not a doctor or anybody. I'm a survivor that's just been through a lot and has worked for 12 years on my healing like a bulldog. So yeah, it's an honor to get to do this work. And thank you for hearing the heart of my story. One of the things I think is interesting about both memoir and trauma is that it's not a litany of what happened to you that is the impact. It is, it's how your body interpreted it. So it's the same thing. And when you're writing the story, it's how what you took from those experiences and how they shaped and formed you. And then the confrontation that you're going to have in your character arc and your character development, very similar to healing from trauma. So they actually pair together really well. And it sounds like you picked up on that. And that means a lot to me. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And thank you also for being open to talking about your experiences, because I know it does mean, even though you've had a lot of experience writing it and talking about it, it still brings you back. And you can feel it, you know, as you're talking about it. And so I do, I always appreciate when people are willing to kind of dive back into that, even physiologically, in order to really talk about it, to educate people, to prevent this from potentially happening in their lives. Just clarification before we get more into personal things. When you talk about evangelical patriarchy being its own thing, and I love the idea of a cult without walls. It's really, really well said. So tell me about the difference, because we've been talking about the Christian patriarchy. So what's evangelical patriarchy?
So evangelical by itself is that method of spreading an idea. There's a few things baked into it. We have the right way. We have the truth. We're going to evangelize you using multiple methods. Lifestyle evangelism is one, direct word to, you know, word of mouth. But it's a force in America. Evangelicism in the Protestant arm is a specific flavor of faith in our country. And it also has a very politicized angle to it, because they want, like, the evangelical Protestant Christian faith has a theology baked into it of we are the right ones. We have the savior of the world. We are a city on the hill. And dominion theology is baked into it. So they aren't just evangelizing out of the goodness of their hearts. They're evangelizing as well to maintain power and Christian dominance, which they can do through multiple methods. So I'm not a historian, and there are better voices for the history of how that happened. But, you know, I've worked on this message for a few years now, trying to get this story to print and out and in my work. And drilling down on what we call it seems to be a really big piece of that, because there's this counter movement, this counter push of, well, not all Christians believe that. And certainly not. There are multiple ways to believe in Christianity. But the especially Southern evangelical American Protestant flavor is very distinct, and it crosses denominational lines. And they will include that in their statement of faith. So the word evangelical is powerful.
Okay. Very interesting. There's a story I think I told on the podcast years ago, but just very briefly. I had invited one of my kids was dating someone whose parents were pastors and teachers at theology school here in Los Angeles. And I invited them to our Hanukkah party, because I invite people to the Hanukkah party. And so they're sitting on the couch, and there were a couple things that were said where at first people were like, okay, because they had moved to a lot of different countries, and they hadn't yet said that they were doing proselytizing. That wasn't mentioned. We thought they were just traveling a lot. And the wife, who had an advanced degree actually over her husband, said, yes, my husband moved us to here, and then my husband moved us to there. And I thought, that's really interesting wording, right? And here she has a PhD, and he, whatever. I don't know. I don't remember what he had or not, but still, she's really like wearing the pants in so many ways in her life. But my husband moved us to Papua New Guinea, and my husband moved us to Ghana and all these places. That's interesting wording. And here, you know, with my family, where it's very egalitarian, you know, at the end of the meal, both the men and the women get up and do the dishes. It's all about that. But then one of the cousins said, so what were you doing in all these countries? That's just wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. And she said, oh, we were bringing the word of God and helping to save them. So here, you know, I have a very liberal, almost socialist family. And, you know, where we would talk about during Thanksgiving, we didn't talk about how Columbus was this great guy, right? We would like collect donations for different Native American tribes in our area. So suddenly when they said, oh, we were, you know, basically saving them, there was this hush that came over the room and no one quite knew what to say. And then my mom, in her very classy way, just did her thing that she does when things are awkward. And she said, coffee, anyone? That was that. But there was this very comfortable way of saying, we came to these places. We knew somehow what they needed. We didn't ask if they're perfectly fine the way they are. We didn't even assume it. Or that what they have is something that's been around for thousands of years, works great for them. But we came with this very entitled feeling that we have what they need. And that's not something that goes over well with a lot of people. But I'm sure if you're in that world, you can start to feel that way. Like, this is, I have something and it would be wrong of me not to, to try to give it to you.
I mean, entitled's one word for it. Supremacy is another. Supremacy and the superiority is both and. It's very power-driven. We're superior, judgmental. We are better than you because we have this truth. But there are so many sincere people who really do believe that they're saving people from hell. Now, Abraham Piper, John Piper's son, has a really good point that he makes. If they truly believed that, they would not be doing anything else in their life. They would be so devoted to saving people from the fires of hell that they wouldn't, there wouldn't be any other thing that they did with their time, you know? So clearly there's a measure of, I don't know, accountability, responsibility, or dismissiveness. Like, there's, we don't really believe that, but we're taught to. And so this idea that it's kind of, you know, a pyramid scheme. The people on the ground are the ones that are traveling, you know, there's their missions, world's missions, and they're telling their neighbors, and there's, they have this line in scripture, in the world, but not of it. And that interpreted means that they're like a parallel society. They're an alternate reality within our reality. And we are definitely seeing that in our country right now, where sure, we're the United States, but we are definitely two parallel realities. They've been honing that for decades under the guise, you know, that verse, be of the world, but not of it. So they've had their separate society and their separate beliefs. And they do believe they're supreme, and the seven mountain mandates, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it means that Christianity should have dominion over these seven categories of the world and of culture. They've been pursuing that very calmly and strategically, you know, for years. And they meet every Sunday to talk about it. Like, one of my jokes is the other side, the more left-leaning or progressive-leaning, however, whatever words we want to use to describe it, we're like not congregating in libraries every Sunday talking about our one world strategy to save the globe.
Right. So there is this kind of, it's happening in the shadows piece to it that feels insidious, actually. And you don't want to look at some kind of religious tradition as insidious, certainly. It feels wrong to do that, but still, if something has been happening in this way that has been surreptitious, that's been an undercurrent where you haven't really realized what they're up to, then it does feel that way. Like, there is this deceptive piece, like we're just like almost this feeling like the enemy is coming through the cloak of, you know, night and darkness and is going to attack at the break of dawn, and you will not have expected it. And so it doesn't feel so comfortable knowing all of this. It's actually quite uncomfortable.
So we see this with the pursuit of religious freedom. They have been proponents of religious freedom, very vocal, like very patriotic. But what we find through their own litmus test is to examine the fruit of what they believe. That's scriptural, and that is what they teach. So looking at the fruit of what they teach, they do not believe in religious freedom for everyone. They want that religious freedom for their own belief system, so that they can then infuse our government with faith. It's supposed to be separation of church and state. They don't really believe that. They want religion in the state So they did the religious freedom over the last few years. We can definitely trace the patterns and the claims. And the fruit of that is that no one else gets religious freedom. There's no plurality or diversity. They start to systemically suppress and oppress people. So I think that's why it feels insidious, because we know they're not talking about freedom for everyone. And they've already started rolling back freedoms for women. I mean, we are recording this the same week that Arizona passed a Civil War era abortion ban. So that's not freedom. That's not freedom for all.
No, certainly not. And I read yesterday that Trump said something about imprisoning doctors who perform abortions. So it's very unsettling. Very, very unsettling and frightening. And in any event, I'm really curious then to go back to your story, because it's interesting. You know, you came from this place of talking about your experience and the experience of the community around you. And it seems that your message has globalized. Like, let's zoom out and let's look at this en masse and see about how what I went through and how I was raised is weaving its way into the world around us. But your experience also was really interesting, because I think that's going to be the experience of more people if this happens, if it really comes to fruition. And I'm sure that's also something upsetting to think about for you.
It is. You're absolutely right. I completely agree with you. I say often that the way the patriarchy runs their homes is the way they want to run the country and the world. You know, we can definitely widen that out to the world. And they don't hide that. That's part of the theology that they teach. So if we want to look at what it's like to live in Christian nationalism, where the Christian patriarchy is in control, we just need to look at households and see, okay, well, how do they live? That means you have to listen to survivors. Now, what's really, I would say, challenging right now is that the violence and trauma and oppression that I ran from, literally got in the car and escaped from, is now in the headlines, coming for my neighbors. That's why my book is so timely, but it's also one of the bigger pain points of telling the story, because I don't take anything they say as hyperbole. I know from scars on my body that they absolutely mean what they say, and they will be imprisoning. They will be, you know, oppressing. They will be changing the laws and the rules. And, you know, they want women out of the workforce. They want us to be not have any contraception and stuff. We know that from looking at the way they already live in their homes and what their model of perfection is for the American family. It's very limited and restricted and very role defined and gender defined. And we don't have to imagine what that world would look like. We just have to listen and learn.
Right. Hopefully people will do that. They will listen and learn, that they will listen to you. They'll read your book. They will listen to others who can say, this is what that looks like. And this is what that feels like. And these are the scars that it leaves physically and emotionally and spiritually too.
Right. Correct.
Right. I mean, it's a trifecta. So going back to your experience a bit, I know that when we talked last time, you were talking about the impact that your life was having on you. And I was really struck by how much you had to balance all at once, that you needed to be caring for others. You needed to be dutiful. You needed to be weathering the storm that was directed at you, you know, keeping you under control. And that you were being abused in so many ways while still needing to be somehow, you know, patient, kind with the people who you loved, who were dependent upon you. I'm not sure how you did it all. When you think about those times, do you also kind of marvel at how you lived through it?
I love her. I've learned a lot of self-compassion for those years. They're complicated because I was complicit in some of my own oppression. And that's true of the patriarchy. I don't believe that it can perpetuate without women. And one of the first things it does is it turns all of the adults in the system, male and female, into those perpetuators. So compassion is necessary to look at that, because I was doing the best I could. And when I knew better, I did better. And that's a very freeing idiom for me to cling to. I had a tenacity of spirit that preserved me, and I'm grateful for that. And I also promised myself, there were multiple times in that experience where if I ever got out, I wouldn't waste my freedom. I would do something with it. I wouldn't, at the very least, I wouldn't allow it to be this way my whole life. I had no idea this was going to happen, you know, and that I would get to this place. But I really feel strongly that it took my past, it took my youth, it took my children's youth. It does not get to have my present and my future, but I'm the only one that can prevent that. I'm the only one that can change the narrative. So that's my promise to myself, younger me and present day me.
Right. Oh, that's quite beautiful. And right, I think being able to think about it in terms of tenses, that this is from the past, and that now you get to decide how much it is part of your present and future, and how it impacts you and how it informs the decisions that you make, and also how you are, how, the lessons that you teach to yourself and to your children and to the public. I'm wondering also, when you told the story about leaving, about getting in the car and leaving, those are things that I have talked to people about who show up in my office and they all piled in a car and just appeared there asking for help. That happens where people are just suddenly needing to escape. And there is some kind of adrenaline that, you know, takes over. And I'm wondering in that moment, if you can take us back to that moment of leaving and what that was like for you. And then to talk about leaving, I want to get into the healing process and how you address what you went through and what you still might be going through. So yeah, let's go back to your escape if we can.
Yeah. So I don't know how much you want to pull back the lens. Time and place was Halloween of 2007. By that point, we had about 7 months of pure hell. My husband's mental health had completely broken, and we were just so close to the end so many times with his ability to stay in this plane, you know, in this reality. And I was scared often, but I wouldn't leave, and I wouldn't leave. And so much of that had to do with my upbringing, believing that to die was better than to get divorced. And I was working through it. I was struggling with my own suicidal ideation. I was praying that he would get in a car accident. You know, I was looking for other ways of escape, anything that would keep me from having to do the thing myself. I don't want to completely spoil the process that happened, but where it eventually landed me was in a hostage situation on Halloween night. He broke and he held me hostage for 4 hours and threatened to bludgeon me, was completely gone and crazy out of his mind. And I was almost preternaturally calm. I didn't speak. I kept my movements very slow. I paid attention to where the weapons and things were in the house, anything that could hurt me. And I just kind of stalled. The kids were in bed, and he left. This plot twist happened. He had never left in a fight before, and he left the house. And in that snap second, I just, as clear as day, heard the word run. And there was no more thinking about it. It was all reflex from there. So maybe that was the adrenaline kick in that you mentioned. I don't believe I really came out of that mental spell that I was in for a couple weeks. I mean, I think it was in shock for a long time. It was very desperate and just get the kids and go. He had gone back to his office to retrieve his gun. We would have been shot if I'd stayed. So I know that it was life or death. It was harrowing. Talked about this already on Shiny Happy People. So if people are familiar with my story, they know that I had that kind of escape. And it was so visceral and so violent. And in a lot of ways, a sharp pivot out. There was no like gentle divorce process or conversations or, you know, anything. It was just so sudden. And it was so last minute and too late. You know, I really did not have to wait that long. I had a priest who was kind of monitoring things and helping me. I could have maybe left in the daytime under less violence if I'd had the courage, but I did not at that time. I was really conditioned to wait on a savior and then wait for a hero and wait for a rescue. And I had to get to the place where I was ready to say, that's not coming. And if anyone's saving my children, it's going to have to be me because I'm the only other adult in the house.
Right. Okay. Okay. And then with children, as you know, as you've probably experienced, they're going to respond a variety of different ways to things like this at their different ages. And you might find out, as a lot of parents do, that there were some kids who were very upset about leaving. Others were relieved because they were feeling scared too, but they couldn't say. And it's often across the board. And so I don't want you to, of course, divulge anything that feels private, but was that the case for you and your family, that that there were some kids who were also really upset about what was happening in the home, and maybe they were hoping for a savior, or were they just used to it?
I think my kids were really confused. And in hindsight, it matters that I was the parent who was home with them all day, and I was also the parent who escaped with them. And I took them to my parents' house. We were very close with my parents when we lived in Florida. So to them, it was a very secure place to land, but it was very confusing. I had, and this is true of a lot of women in my position, I had propped up my family, both our image, our PR, and the operations of the day. I'm the one that did the homeschooling and the housework and the meal prep. And so for a child, my kids were 10 and under, 10 to 2 on down at that time. I was the center of their universe. And so in their perception, I was more impactful than their dad, who would come home and be too violent and have fits. And he was having deranged fits at that time. But they got long breaks from him. And so they also had that element of hero worship and, you know, this is my dad. And then overnight, they kind of lost him. I mean, they didn't kind of lose him. They lost him. He never had visitation or custody after that time. It was a very dramatic 10-year custody issue of analysis of his mental health and fitness as a parent, which he was never found fit. So that never happened. So for my kids to process massive lifestyle change, a very abrupt rupture of their family and loss, you know, loss of everything. Because we left their house, we left their toys, their belongings, their father, their pets, like everything was gone. So I think they were just really confused because I'd sheltered them from as much as I could and borne it with my own body as much as I could. And even to this day, they're not fully aware of the events that happened in our home.
Right. And, you know, that's sometimes a good thing that they don't need to know, or they might start inquiring later on and then, you know, you'll decide how much to share. But it's interesting that you were bearing the brunt with your own body. That's very, very emotional, very powerful. That's the selfless parent. It's a beautiful thing. And at the same time, tragic that that's what it took to protect them.
Also, the word selfless is very complicated. When I left, I had no sense of self. And when I lived in that world, your sense of self is destroyed. You're taught to die to self. And all of that service and management that we talked about a few moments ago, all of that requires I have no personal identity. You can't serve in that kind of that capacity and across that many different areas if you are being an individual. So I didn't have any. I had, you know, a malformed sense of child development and self-development. I had a shitty self-worth, which I really railed against. Anytime anybody said an abuse victim has a low self-worth, I feel like that blames the victim for somehow choosing their situation. And there are no good choices in patriarchy. You don't get good options that a self-worth would be able to, you know, see and choose wisely. That doesn't exist. So, but I had none. And so, yes, I was selfless, but I was also selfless. And I had to rebuild a sense of self as I worked my way out of that.
Right. So let's move into that, because there's a lot to talk about, you know, the question I get asked a lot by clients, which is an unusual question for most therapists to receive, which is who am I? What am I for? Not only kind of what's my purpose, but what do I think? And how do I feel? And what do I like? And so there's a lot to forming a self, isn't there?
All of those are very big existential questions when you come out of this world. Like, and we joke about it. We'll say, oh, she can't pick where to go to dinner. It's funny, but it's also not funny. Like, a grown woman should be able to identify what she's hungry for and what kinds of foods she likes. But it's almost passé to say, well, whatever you want, honey, because that's what's so ingrained into us. Yeah, it's the self-development, the self-awareness of who am I. Everything was defined by what I did. Everything was... I thought, well, I'm a mom, I'm a sister, I'm a daughter. It took me, honestly, years to get to the place. Before all that, I was Tia, and I am Tia at the core. And Tia is more than any job she has or role she serves in. That really has taken the last 16 years of building myself, you know, element by element. So much of healing attention is on wound attention, like, what happened to you and where is it showing up and where, what hurts and how is it manifesting in your body? And that is a whole aspect of healing that thankfully has grown over the past 16 years. The language has developed, There are therapists and doctors using, you know, even job titles that didn't exist 16 years ago. So it's wonderful that that's developing. But what I found is that that could also be very distracting. I spent so much time focused on what happened to me and how it hurt and how it was manifesting. And it wasn't really until I discovered that the self-development, the self piece of it, that was what the core that was missing, that put everything into perspective so that I could make it the most of a modality and that I could make choices for myself or choose myself in a situation, you know, choose me, be loyal to me. I didn't know what that was. And I didn't know, I didn't even know how to say that sentence. Probably until the last 5 years. Taking a lot of work.
Right. Yeah. People being loyal to you when it's still, I'm sure, just a difficult thing to think about following the sentence that starts with, I want.
I had no I statements. I had none. It's always Jesus, others, you. Jesus, others, you spells joy. And it is the criteria every woman is supposed to use when deciding what to do with her day, her life, her reason. You make the bottom list, you are the why, but you never get down there because by the time you're serving what people are telling you is Jesus serving, like it's usually working in the kitchen somewhere or you know, taking care of people. And then the O is also conveniently others. There's no time in the day for you. Like there's no self-care. There's no time. You'd just be waiting forever for it to be my turn.
That is an incredible thing. So there are no I statements just for women.
Yeah.
And same thing also for girls. Can girls use I statements or they learn young to not?
They learn young not. I mean, this whole girl empowerment movement that we have is, that doesn't exist.
Incredible. Oh my goodness. Okay, right. So an I statement, how to use an I statement also without feeling wrong about it.
Right.
Yeah, that it's punishable somehow, it's sinful.
So many people I talk to struggle with this guilt of taking up even any space, you know, and you see this reflected when they're like hyper apologizing for everything. I'm really sorry. And they didn't do anything wrong, but they just, I'm sorry is baked into polite speech. And they just over apologize or overthink or over protect, you know, there's just no, or too trusting, you know, like there's no sovereignty. And that's a hard word. Like, saying that I'm sovereign, and that's, I'm still kind of unpacking that one because I immediately feel little bits come up in my body when I say a word like that.
Right. I'm wondering though, to have you talk about the healing process, because this is something you're going to be addressing in your book. And I know there are some things that you're able to leave behind you and other things that have real staying power, unfortunately, that really get under your skin. And if you can talk about those things and also about the parts work, some people are familiar with that, some people not. And what else has been good for your healing? So I want to learn from you on that. So I'm going to let you just speak. Go for it.
Yeah. We have to try and travel a little bit more. We go back to, so I escaped in 2007 and worked through a lot of triage and shock and trying to get on my feet. I also spent a year in hiding, actually on the run. So if you have trauma responses that involve flight energy and then you actually have to flee, it is very impactful on the body and the entire nervous system, which I did not have nervous system language until just a few years ago. Because like I said, this has all evolved along the same time as my character arc and my healing. So the language hasn't always been there, but language is ironically where it started. My very, very first therapist after leaving started out by naming what happened, putting the proper names on my experiences, because in my case, marital rape, I had 50 ways to describe with a very long story what happened. And she just drilled it right down to the word. And then when I had to accept that vocabulary word, I had something else to tangle with and to explore and to come into acceptance. And that got me through probably that process about 4 years. And then I'm sure you're very familiar with the body keeps the score and how trauma is stored in the body and somatic and all of that. Somatic's another new word like the last couple of years, but that was happening and I got really sick. I got debilitated. It was awful. Everything white turned pink. I had week-long migraines. I couldn't get out of bed. It was awful. And I went through a huge medical journey. And at the end, you know, doctors were, I had second and third opinions and all of the imagery. And the doctors were kind of befuddled. And then one of them kind of threw up his hands and he said, I can't guarantee this, but I think you have MS. And I don't have great language other than, oh, hell no, that rose up inside of me. Like that moment in his office was such a galvanizing, crystal clear rebellion that I was 35 at the time. There is no way on earth that my entire adulthood and my one lifetime on this planet is going to be given over to trauma. And I asked him, are you very sure I have MS? Can you prove it? And he said, no, I think we'll just see if you have more episodes of it and that will confirm it. And I said, well, then I don't have it. And I, in that moment, now I don't know that this, not everyone can do this. You can't just declare that you don't have an illness. But I took that window, that sliver of possibility, and I decided to dig in with everything I had. I approached healing with an obstinance that I don't always see people hold on to. So I know that there's a uniqueness to my story here, but it's what I encourage people to tap into. Find wherever your oh hell no moment is that you have some fight in yourself. You have to advocate for yourself. This is another thing that's missing in the whole like religious background is that we don't have advocates. We're taught to wait on external advocates and we don't have any internal agency. And I had to get like when I'm on the floor and I'm deciding I'm the only adult in the house and I have to leave. That was a moment of advocacy, self-advocacy, get up and get your kids out of there. And I had to do the same thing in healing. No one was going to externally heal me. There was no medication or protocol that was going to heal me. So I started 12-step programs. I started with Al-Anon and codependency. And that gave me a whole bunch of little platitudes that I still hold on to. Do the next right thing. Like that's how I medically healed my body was what's the next thing. I sat down and I visualized and wrote down, what does a healthy Tia look like? How does she live? Where does she sleep? What are her relationships like? How does she eat? Where does she work? What's her job? What does she do? Because I had to have some sort of vision that would help me move towards that, you know, target. Then I did a vision board so that I would have a visualization. Now I have a victory board because so much of my vision board came true. I was like, I have to be able to see my accomplishments. So every time I hit one of those, it goes on my victory board. I had to put my expressiveness on this and I had to put like every shred of my doggedness. So I have really done every modality that pretty much comes up. I'll give it a shot. And very often before their talking points, so like I was really early into EMDR. I did brain spotting, internal family systems, which is the parts work that I referred to. I know you know, but the listeners may not. It's the multifaceted mind. And the easiest way to get to it is part of me feels this and part of me feels that. Well, that part has experiences and memories and responses that are inside of you and they're impacting your decisions. So getting to know my parts and my inner child and me, the inner me at every stage has been so life-giving. And then also somatic work, like where do I feel something in my body and what's coming up? And learning to do that without judgment has been really huge. Like I see it and I don't analyze it or do anything but name it and then try to work through it. And luckily, I currently have a therapist who specializes in IFS and somatic awareness. So, but in 2020, during the pandemic, when everything was, you know, pretty much hitting the fan for everybody, that's when I really identified that my sense of self had, that was the missing key. Like I just didn't have any of the phrases that we put self on the front as a prefix. I didn't have self-agency, self-care, self-worth, self-esteem, I was self-betraying. That's what I was doing a lot of. And so 2020 was a pivotal year.
I'm really taken by how open you've been, but also it sounds like you've had people in your life who have been able to show you that you can trust them, that they are people you can be open to and, you know, the techniques. And going back to something you said before, it sounds like part of the healing has been that it's been multisensory, that you can hear it, you can see it, you can do it, you feel it. And that's probably also been really helpful.
I envision that it's a lot like just child development, what should have happened in the first place. So we don't run before we walk and we don't stay inside the lines before we've ever touched a crayon. And I had to rebuild myself that way. So when I'm talking about that chronology and the way that I've tried everything, each one hasn't been like a cure. Like EMDR wasn't a cure to me. It was one more layer and one more strengthening muscle group, motor skill, you know, ability to get to the next thing. And so it really did build on itself so that I could become an actualized person, which is the same thing that happens in healthy child development as you grow and mature and then differentiate from your caregivers, you become an actualized person. I really didn't turn that corner until 2020 because I was, you know, building myself. And all of those efforts are important, but none of them can be taken and siloed apart as some sort of curative. It has been very multisensory because I'm multisensory. I like a good blend of intellect and art. I need it all. I need it all. And I feel like I can have it all because I can hold it all. That's who I am now. That's myself. Myself is like a kaleidoscope, multifaceted. And that's why my approach is that way.
I did want to say, you know, it's reminding me, I one time did an exercise for kids, but I think it's also something that I could use with adults. There were kids who had come off a compound who didn't know how to answer questions. They didn't know they could ask questions and they didn't know who they were and a lot of it. And I remember being asked early on, how do I know who I am or what I am? And for some reason, the first answer I had, which has stuck quite a bit, is let's decide first who you're not. And let's decide what you're not, like what you feel is not in line with you. Even things that maybe you were taught are fine, or things that you needed to do or say to other people, but it didn't feel right. I remember doing an outline of a body, just the outline so that you could write. It was on poster board, so you could write inside sort of, this is who I am. And so first we did a not, this is who I'm not. And all the things that bother the person, that even things they're allergic to, just what they're not, what they can't eat, and just down to the details. And then we were able to switch over to who they are, but also the who they are. For some reason, I said, let's do that in pencil, because that doesn't have to be set in stone, right? That can change over time. And, you know, and I remember thinking, just as you're talking, that I did this with children, but I could see it being a useful thing for adults. I think it was probably going to be useful for me. I could have done it for myself when I came out of a very controlling relationship, like who I am and who I'm not and who I'm allowed to be and what I'm allowed to want, you know, all those things too. It's interesting exercise.
One of the things I say a lot that is a non-judgmental differentiation statement is that is not for me. I'll say it's like fine for you, you know, but that is not for me because I know what is for me. I've spent enough time getting to know that what is and what's not, you know, difference that I know if something is not a fit for me, it doesn't fit. And it's just like that pair of pants doesn't fit me. This pair of pants does. That's, you know, also with boundaries, I spend more time on my I can statements. What can I do? Instead of what can't I do? And they are I statements. They're not about controlling other people. That was another breakthrough for me with boundaries. So one of the places where I allow myself without apology, as you were saying, is with spirituality. So people are always asking me, are you still a Christian? They really want to peg me into an ideology so that they can feel safe and know like what she stands for and should I listen to her? And that's denied. Evangelical children. They're not allowed any privacy around their spirituality from the beginning. And they're not allowed to be fluid and change their minds. So my answer is I'm spiritually private. And then they ask, well, what does that mean? And then I say, you know, I think faith and spirituality are fluid. And I give myself permission to ebb and flow without being put into a box. And also personally, I love a good fundamentalism. I crave easy answers, just like the rest of us, and formulas. And this is my way of not allowing myself to go in that direction again. As soon as you answer that question, you put yourself into a lane. And that's my private business. My little child self wasn't given that. And we would say, you know, if you're going to die tonight, do you know where you would go? We would ask this of perfect strangers, you know, are you going to go to heaven or hell? And then we would start the process of evangelizing them. And that's all very boundary violating. It's not respectful at all. And so that's one of the ways that I take care of me. Like you've mentioned a few times that this work is activating and that it does touch on the old stuff. And I've got my boundaries really clear and I've got my talking points figured out. And I know what's okay to talk about and how and what's off limits. For instance, I don't ever talk about my kids and specific experiences, their names, their details, anything that would be their own interpretation of what they experienced. That's off limits. So yes, I am going to be activated by the past, and that feels appropriate, but I've managed my nervous system and abilities to know like where my boundaries are and my skills to work through activation and know when I need to draw lines and say no.
Right. There are some moments where I realize that I'll make a comment that feels like just an offhand kind of comment, but I can see how it's landing suddenly. And I realize, oh, let me look at that with these people and see why that was actually very big. I remember when I was running a support group, one of the first support groups I was running, one of the members or participants asked another participant a question, and it felt personal to me, but that person felt the obligation to answer it, either because they were people pleasing or because of how they were trained, or both. So I just jumped in before she answered the question. And I said, let me just say that, you know, just because someone asks you a question doesn't mean you have to answer it. And there was this silence that was like palpable. Wait, what? But what? And I thought, wow, that's interesting. Okay, let's look at why that feels monumental, but also was fraught with so much anxiety. What do you mean? And how's that person going to feel about you? And then are they going to think you're hiding something? And, you know, all the things that were then going to be supposed because of you saying, you know what, that's my information and maybe for another time or not, but, you know, I'm happy to talk about other things that you can do it gracefully. But just learning that you have that right, you can also change your mind. But in that moment, you can say no.
That is a huge retraining process. Children in this environment are not allowed to say no about anything from the youngest ages. And that's one of the reasons why sexual abuse is so rampant in this world, because they're not allowed to say no to an adult that wants something from them. And it would never occur to them to be able to say no. And the idea that someone pushed back or fought back is unusual. It's to hear somebody that's resisting, because that's what's ingrained. So in an adult, more public manifestation of that is that, no, you can't not answer a question. If someone's asking you something, you owe them, you are obligated, you are disobedient and wrong if you withhold that, something is wrong with you. And so that's not an overnight switch. That's just like, for example, the vocal training that a lot of evangelical women have to go through. I certainly retrained my voice when I left. That took time. That takes a lot of like time to know that you're not in trouble if you politely decline to answer a question.
So let's talk about the vocal training, because right, a lot of people are going to think, oh, you took singing lessons? No. I mean, maybe, but let's talk about what you're talking about. So what did you need to retrain yourself to do and how to sound?
Yeah, this, if you Google Fundy baby voice, that's the phrase that everyone latched onto after Katie Britt's State of the Union. We never called it Fundy baby voice. That's not something we use. That's an outsider term used for this phenomena that people are starting to pay attention to now. And if you're familiar with Michelle Duggar, you've definitely heard her use it. It's in culture. Marilyn Monroe used it. But the feminine baby childlike voice, also called keep a gentle spirit, keep sweet, goes by a lot of different names. Mormons call it the primary voice because you're speaking to primary children. It's a kind of prosody that is used to coax and manipulate. You're trying to convey a feeling of safety and subservience so you're not threatening, you're a female. And this high-pitched voice, and I'm not even going to replicate it for you if people are interested, you can go Google it or just go listen to Katie Britt. Like, it's breathy, it's sexy, it's childlike, it's baby, and it's strange to hear an educated and adult woman use it. And we are trained in that from youth. The other thing that comes with this voice is that a lot of sexual trauma victims will also display it. It's been a marker. And it's both and. People will ask me, well, doesn't it mean sexual abuse happened in their childhood? And I was like, those two don't cancel each other out. Very likely both happened. And so this baby voice, I definitely used it for until I escaped long past. And it was a vocal coach. I was a writer, a freelance writer at the time. And I spoke to somebody who is one of my clients. And she said, your voice has no gravitas in it. You don't sound like an adult. And it was because she said it so clearly that I was able to like finally hear it and realize, talk about not know myself. I don't even know what myself sounds like. I've talked like this performance voice. And the performance voice is always a manipulation. What you're saying very rarely matches the way it sounds. So a disciplining parent will use it. They're about to spank you and they're talking in this high-pitched baby voice. So retraining is long and extensive. You have to get to know your sound. I did sing out loud a lot, but I also saw speech therapists and vocal coaches and practiced with my camera a lot so I could hear myself speak back and just hear the normal tone of my voice. I'm not artificially modulating my voice in any way right now, but that took practice and years of awareness and listening back and feedback.
Wow. It's good to have someone say, no, you're not sounding rude. No, you're not talking too much. No, that's not too loud. And to have that frame of reference, because I'm sure you can feel really aggressive suddenly when you're just using a regular voice. So your frame of reference is often you need to check in, or you're hoping that by apologizing, someone will relieve you of that worry and affirm that everything was fine.
It's always about what gets me back to a feeling of safety. We live in a perpetual trauma response when we come out of high control religion. We're always fawning or freezing or flighting or fighting. And for me, it was freeze and fawn are my two go-tos. Flight when I'm stressed. That's always contingency planning. I have contingency plans for my contingency plans. But the fawning is complicated because Christian girls are raised to fawn, but that's also a way to stay safe when you're in a dangerous high control environment.
And so what did fawning look like for you when you were growing up?
Servitude, softness, anticipating someone else's needs before they would speak. And that was a place of pride. The idea that I could see that somebody needs something and take care of it before they had to ask was something I got good at. Obeying the rules really, really well. Sometimes making the rules stricter than they were prescribed to show how perfect I could be. Another one, particularly with eating. I had an eating disorder for many of those years. And that was me making it stricter than someone had prescribed to me. It was purity of lifestyle and purity of body. And I took those rules and ran with them.
Right. Yeah. The idea of overcompensating for safety is something that a lot of people do when they've been raised around abuse too. And so they will do the extra. What gets lost in that is if it's necessary, if that was energy you were supposed to give to yourself, even though I know there isn't really a supposed to, there isn't a supposed to for you. There's a supposed to for everybody else.
That is something interesting to call back to the Jesus others you thing, to flip that and to be self-loyal first does mean that there will be less that you can go the extra mile on. I can't overperform for others anymore. Very rarely. I have to be very convinced that there's a reason for it. My needs have to come first. It is so hard for me to even say that sentence. But it's true. I like as simple as the oxygen mask first on the flight in the safety instructions, that metaphor is given a lot. If I haven't slept or eaten or drunk water or, you know, thought my things through or felt prepared or the things that I know I need to feel safe myself, that's not dependent on anyone else that I'm responsible for, then I can't actually overperform for you. I can't actually, and I will. My work ethic used to be such an overachiever. And I am a person that has a high capability. So it's really easy to go that way and immediately rewarding. They love a good overachiever. But I can't be loyal to myself and burn myself out that way anymore. So yeah, I usually say should is the devil. Every should statement usually is you're going to go down the wrong road if you follow that. But that's the priority now is, yes, I am supposed to come first. Because if I don't come first, I'm no good to anyone else.
Right. So I know we just have a little bit of time left. And I was curious about, you know, so much of healing that I think people can learn how to do a little bit better is some self-talk. Because there are times that people, when they're dealing with trauma or they're dealing with anxiety, they're given exercises to change how they are physiologically, like grounding techniques, etc. But sometimes it doesn't work necessarily because it might not work, but also because they have these ruminating thoughts that they're not addressing. While they're counting to 10, they're thinking, I don't deserve happiness. You know, it sort of becomes a zero-sum game. So What have you learned to say? And I know that you mentioned some of the things that you've learned to say to your child. But what have you learned to say when suddenly you might have that thought of not feeling deserving or panic that you said no? What helps to keep you feeling calm and secure in that moment that not all literally hell is going to break loose?
I've gotten pretty efficient at this process. This is just what works for me. I don't know that it will work for anyone else. But when I start to feel that, because racing thoughts are something that I definitely have dealt with, and intrusive thoughts I've dealt with before. So when I'm activated, my nervous system is activated, and I start to have the nervous system response with the flushing or my faster heartbeat, or I get sweaty. I've learned to put my hand on my chest and say, whoa, stop. What do you need? And just that, like my whole body goes back. What do you need? The voice will come forward. And this is the crossover to parts work. There's a part back there whose job it was to help me survive. And they are having a hard time with something I'm choosing to do because they think it's going to threaten my survival. And I need to have a conversation with that part. So a conversation with that part looks like getting my notebook out. If I have time for it, sometimes I can just do this really quickly. But if I can't do it really quickly, if it's a big thing, then I get my journal out. It's a 5-subject notebook. And I just pick a page and I stream of consciousness, ask the part, what's coming up? What are you worried about? What's your concern? Do you know how old I am? I have this covered. Thank you for sharing. You know, like usually just needs to be validated. Know that I know that that's its concern and that I have things under control. My self energy has it under control. When it's really fast, I can just go, whoa, stop. What do you need? And usually, so often, a shockingly amount of the time, often, I'm thirsty. I need to pee. Like it's so creature comfort, and that my nervous system just needs what it needs to come back down. And I have capacity to deal with this problem. I have capacity to deal with this situation, but I've neglected something, and some other part of me is raising an alarm. Like, hey, you haven't taken care of you yet. And we promised to do that. We promised to take care of Tia first. So you have to actually give me some water before you can go have that conversation.
I love that. That's really, really important. Self-care is really, yes, you can tell how much it's overlooked, how much it's put down as a priority, how much you're put down as a priority.
And it's not bubble baths, you know, like bubble baths and luxurious robes and things like that as self-care. They're fun. But what I call self-care now is just so much more basic.
The lesson that you're teaching here is that even what seem like small things aren't small things. And that self-care matters in such a monumental way. But right, it really is put down. I think so many people in cultic systems are underslept, underfed, and they're supposed to somehow survive like that.
As are their babies. You know, their babies are that way. Their babies are crying it out and not having their needs tended. And when you get into parts work, you find out a lot of your parts are really young. And so when they're speaking up in adulthood, their needs are really primal. I think that's why those needs are so basic, because I was a baby who cried it out. I was a colicky. I was 6 pounds born with a tooth, and I screamed for like the first year. That's my mom's story. And so that little wailing infant, desperate for probably nervous system regulation, she was probably very anxious, needs to have basic needs met. So when I'm an adult doing my very cult survivor adult parts, you know, survival work, healing work, it's shocking how often that means I'm just going to go reparent myself with some kindness. And I had a loving mom, but, you know, she didn't know what to do with me. And she was in a system where Dr. Spock said, let your babies cry.
Right. That's right. Dr. Spock. Right. So just as we're finishing up, what's something that you think is a really lovely takeaway that you've learned just in terms of having, you know, kind of patience with you and your healing and giving it time and feeling hopeful also about things, like even when it feels like some of the parts are needing still more care, just feeling hopeful that you'll be able to potentially transcend that or care for it moving forward?
Yeah, something I've really focused on a lot is that healing is not linear, and it is my life. Like there's no like milestone where you're healed now and that's done. And now you're going forward as a healed person. I will always be somebody who lived through this and survived this. And it will be part of my story and my fabric and my awareness for the rest of my life. But healing is the same way. And healing is just means living. So if I'm living in a spirit of healing, I am healing. I don't think I'll be healed till I'm dead. Then it won't matter. So, you know, just focus on that. Imbuing my life with healing is what I expect to do. And the best way that I can do that now is pass that on to other people. I think there are so many hurting survivors that despair that they will always be defined by the past. And I just don't even have, I find that unacceptable. That's not why you were given your one wild and precious life. To quote Mary Oliver, you weren't here to just be someone else's victim. So, you know, there's progress to be made. And it's very personal, very individual, but very possible.
Wow. Okay. Very wise. So it's such a pleasure always to talk to you, to commiserate with you, to learn from you. And I hope we get to do it again.
Yes, same. Thank you so much.
Of course. So tell people about the book coming up and the book that you have now and where they can find it and what they're called, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. Well, the big one is A Well-Trained Wife. Comes out in August 6th. It's already available for pre-order anywhere books are sold. It will be in hardcover, ebook, and audio. And yes, I'm reading it. Those are the most frequently asked questions about that book. I'm working on the second book now, which is on healing and isn't yet named. I think the working title will change. I write a column on Substack called The Anti-Fundamentalist. It's tialevings.substack.com. And I educate on the abuses of Christian fundamentalism on social media. So that's at @TiaLevingsWriter on all the platforms.
Perfect. Wonderful. Good. Good to talk to you again. Always a pleasure.
You too.
One more thing before you go. It was so nice to have Tia back on the show, and I hope that she comes to talk to us again. It's really, really lovely to speak with her and so important. I love what she said about waiting for a savior, and then she realized the savior was her, and she was going to save herself. That is a very empowered statement, and so good for people to see that that's possible. I remember reading a Joan Didion book where she says the same, that she was waiting for someone to rescue her, and then she realized that person needed to be her. And also, sometimes when you rescue yourself, in a more empowered way, not only because you are able to do it, but you see that you were able to step in for yourself when needed. And so that means you don't have to rely on other people to do it or wait any longer, even though it does feel lovely to have people swoop in to rescue you. It is, I think, more important to know that it's something that you can place on your own shoulders and take care of. I want to get into something that Tia talked about that is going to be known by some of the people listening, but not by most, this idea of the seven mountain mandate. So I want to be able to get into each of these seven mountains. And I'm going to be giving my own 2 or 3 cents about each one. So this is not going to be an objective viewpoint at all about it, because I have a lot of reaction to it. So the seven mountain mandate is a concept in Christian dominionism, as we were talking about, a belief system that advocates for the application of Christian principles in all areas of society. This mandate suggests that Christians are called to influence and bring about transformation in these seven key areas or mountains of culture. So the seven mountains are, as Tia described, she went through the list of them: religion, family, education, government, media, arts and entertainment, and business. So the proponents of the seven mountain mandate believe that by gaining influence in these areas, Christians can shape society and advance God's kingdom on earth. Lots of critics, though, will argue that this approach can blur the lines between church and state. Yep. And may impose religious beliefs on diverse and pluralistic societies, people who are of different religions, people who are of no religion, etc. So let's look at each one. So the religion mandate, religion mountain, I guess. So this advocates for the spread of Christian values and beliefs within religious institutions and communities. So it doesn't necessarily say just Christian religious institutions and communities. It really is to spread Christian beliefs in all. And it's already happening in a lot of different places, states within the United States and countries around the world. And it's something that has an inherent, at least from what I can see and what I feel, it has an inherent disrespect built into it, deciding that other people's religious beliefs are not either sufficient or don't have as much merit or are not the right ones. And so it's okay to infuse your Christian beliefs into other areas and other belief systems, which is going to this idea of dominion, and I would see it as this idea of superiority or believed superiority, which is, of course, a problem, which has been built into religion, I think, through time immemorial. And it's one of these things that I have always found difficult because I think of spiritual communities as having a different moral and ethical kind of guideline than that. I see it as the sort of the golden rule, the do unto others, the let's all get along kind of way of looking at things. Let's treat our neighbors as ourselves. Let's be peacefully coexistent. But that's not the way many people within this whole movement believe. Then you have the second part, which is family. So it promotes the importance of Christian values, Christian family values, and aims to influence family dynamics and structures according to biblical principles. So this is where you get into the idea, basically, to a great degree, that, you know, divorce is not allowed and abortion is not allowed, depending upon the belief system. But I've seen it, and Tia was talking about it, that a husband can treat his wife like a child and can be abusive. I mean, it goes beyond issues of safety and where the law has come in to establish that spouses have rights and the same rights they have in the world outside, that people can't mistreat them and can't force them into having sex. There can be rape within marriage, and that would be to a great degree repealed here, which is sending the rights mainly of female spouses. I know this is also going to be a problem for men, but the rights of female spouses back many, many years, and I think has a lot of frightening consequences for things that will be allowed behind closed doors. And it's also something that worries me on behalf of children, because children raised in those environments and grow up feeling scared and also very protective of the person who is being abused or looking down, you know, being taught to look down on the one being abused as being deserving of that, which then prompts them to grow into having this dysfunctional way of looking at their own rights. If they are abused, well, it's because they deserved it. Or the person who grows up in this kind of environment and then is afraid of getting into a relationship of any kind because they know this is something that could happen to them. It also does a disservice to the boys and the ones who grow into men who are going to be treating people this way, because they don't learn, I think, self-control, and they don't learn about respect, and they don't learn to see people of another gender as equals. That's going to be problematic in their life in many ways, not just for the other gender, but for them. Because these are the people also who are going to get into trouble in workplaces and other environments where they think that they can also just mistreat the females around them. So the next one is education. So this seeks to impact educational systems and curricula, emphasizing Christian teachings and moral values. So you already have the fact that the Ten Commandments are supposed to be shown in public school classrooms within a particular state, within the United States. And there is already an encroachment, which is, of course, problematic, and especially within non-parochial environments, in the public school system that is paid for by our tax dollars, which is an erosion of the separation of church and state. And people are going to be of a particular assumption that if you send your child to a school that is not religious, that they're not going to be swayed one way or another to believe something or to think that the way they believe is correct or incorrect, that it's not going to be even talked about. But that is something that this whole movement is hoping to be able to shift and to make sure that there is no separation within government. And this is where it gets scary to me because of how I've seen governments that take on certain kinds of religious leanings, and it is highly destructive. And sometimes this is how wars are started, and how people within certain places, certain countries, are made to have to leave in droves if they don't want to convert to something, or are sometimes killed in very extreme cases. I mean, you know, we have history of that all over the world. I'm thinking of the Inquisition, situations that happened many years ago, but are still happening now. So within government, there is this encouragement for Christians to engage in political processes and governance to establish laws and policies that reflect Christian ethics. And in these kinds of ways of looking at it, when we use the term Christian ethics, there are a lot of people who are Christian who will say, that's not ethical. So already it's a misnomer. And people of other religions who really want to know that they're going to be protected and their rights are going to be protected and the government will help uphold that are also going to find this unethical. Then the media and the fact that you can reach millions of people in a second with an idea, with being able to get a message across in a repeated way, with having so many people who are targeted to get certain kinds of messaging without realizing they're being targeted and bombarded. Within the media, they aim to influence entertainment, basically, to promote positive faith-based content and counteract negative or secular messages. And often, negative is equal to secular within religious teachings or religious environments. It's also not just to promote positive faith-based content, but I think fear-mongering content. And that's also where it gets highly problematic and dangerous. And then within arts and entertainment, where there's a focus on transforming the arts and entertainment industry to reflect Christian values and ideals. To all the shows that we see and the plays that we can watch and the musicals and all of it. So many times people will say that they were exposed to and sensitized to the plight of certain kinds of people, and they were able to become more inclusive in their thinking more tolerant in their thinking because of a play they saw, because of a show they watched. And this mandate is hoping, I think, to erase that possibility, that capability. And then within business, advocates for ethical business practices and leadership that align with Christian principles, emphasizing integrity, fairness, and stewardship. And that all sounds good, except that within business, business should be business. And if it is a Christian business, it should say that. And you should know what you're supporting. And you should know also if there's going to be a bias against you in terms of hiring and firing practices. And if there is going to be this manipulation to abandon your belief system for the belief system they think you should have. It already happens within certain cults, with certain large group awareness trainings, where there are some companies that force, actually, their employees to go on these weekend workshops that they only find out later are sponsored by cultic groups because the people in charge of that company are members of that group or make a profit by doing this, get a cut. And so there are so many things that happen that are underhanded when it comes to this, where people are just trying to make a living and they're just trying to go to work. And instead, they're told what's wrong with them, how they need to change, how they need to believe a different way. And that's not what they signed up for, or that's not what they got that degree to have to be exposed to have to be backed into that corner that they have to believe a certain way, or they have to relinquish their own belief system or the ties to their family that is part of a different belief system in order to keep being able to support their own families and be able to keep their job. All of this is problematic. And what is also problematic is that the idea of dominion is one that has no end. And so it's not saying we really hope to be able to make a difference in some aspects of people's lives and they can take it or leave it. It really is to take over. And I find that frightening. I find it to be the picture of hubris and unethical and amoral. And I hope that people will become more aware of these trends, of this push, because so much of it is happening without us noticing. And that's why I'm spending time trying to expose it. So you'll be aware and you can try to be as on top of it as possible. Thank you, thank you, thank you to Tia for helping to educate us about this and so many other things. Take care. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them. And guess what? That's normal. Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. At ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.